Jean Shinoda Bolen, psychiatrist, mystic, Jungian analyst, and professor, is the author of the books Goddesses in Every Woman, Gods in Every Man, and Crossing to Avalon.
Windows of the Soul by Jean Shinoda Bolen, MD. Whenever I experience something beautiful, I am with soul. That moment of inward breath, that pause and awareness of how beautiful this is a prayer of appreciation, a moment of gratitude in which I behold beauty and am one with it. I have come to appreciate that having an aesthetic eye takes me effortlessly into soul. The beauty of where I live is the emotional equivalent of being in a cathedral with light streaming in through stained glass windows. My first impression on awakening is usually how beautiful it is. Living as I do on the side of a mountain, I have a panoramic view over the San Francisco Bay and often see the sun rising over the East Bay Hills. Sometimes the fog obscures the view and lends a mysterious, private quality to where I am. It's always different, always special, and always beautiful. It's also quiet. To look out my windows and feel as I do in response to what I see is an effortless spiritual practice. There is a timelessness and serenity to my unhurried mornings. Just about every morning I sit with a cup of coffee, gaze outward, and am in a receptive space in myself. Ideas, thoughts, and feelings come to mind. They rise to the surface, where I can think about them or make further intuitive connections. The experience is like being a still pool in the forest, and simultaneously being at the edge of the pool, observing what arises from its depths. It is the same when I am doing my best writing, which I also do in the mornings, or more accurately, when writing has to do with being totally absorbed in the shaping of what comes effortlessly to mind from my depths. In the timelessness of these moments of creativity, there is always a fullness of soul as well. Another place where I find soul, one of the strongest places, is in the presence of other people whom I meet at soul level. It happens whenever a dialogue takes place in which both people are truly present, tuning in to really hearing each other and reflecting back. A sense of discovery occurs, as when musicians get together and improvise a musical dialogue, a dialogue that depends on letting go of ego and defenses. To voice something you're feeling and put observations into words with another person who is totally present is a creative act embodying soul and love. When people come for therapy, soul is present. When they speak to me of the experiences that have affected them deeply, trusting me with their vulnerability, or tell me dreams rich with symbolic meaning, or reveal what they have never shown another person, I know that we are meeting at soul level, that we are not just in an office, but in sanctuary, and that an invisible, transpersonal, healing energy enters our space. They speak with a natural eloquence, and emotionally, an expressiveness and trust that touch my heart. If I'm also listening with an ear for prose poetry, very often a beauty of form comes through in their phrases. I think that whenever soul is present, it's because what you're doing, whom you're with, where you are, evokes love without your thinking about it. You are totally absorbed in the place or person or event without ego and without judgment. You are in what the Greeks call kairos. When you are in kairos time, you are totally absorbed in what you are doing. You lose track of time. Whether you are in love with a person or in love with a project, it's the same quality. Time may expand. You feel that the experience has been happening for hours and it's really been 45 minutes. Or maybe you've spent hours and it seems that only 45 minutes have gone by. Time is not measured. You are participating in time as you make a connection through the deeper creative parts of yourself, and that connection nourishes the soul, always. What particular experiences will nourish your soul? No one can prescribe that for you. It is something only you can know and experience. What is satisfying for one person may be just the opposite for someone else. Being out in nature by the seashore or on a mountaintop works for me. Communing with nature brings me into soul time. But for others, being out in nature is something to be tolerated, or even an ordeal, or just what you do if you're a member of a family that goes camping. For some people, listening to or playing music is a soulful experience, while for others, music is a way to mark time until they can get on to something productive. While everyone has a different experience of what is soulful, these experiences do share similar beginnings. We start by giving ourselves permission to be soulful, to take seriously this aspect of ourselves, our soul, and our soul needs. You have the need and the right to spend part of your life caring for your soul. It is not easy. There are many obstacles. You have to resist the demands of the work-oriented, often defensive element in your psyche that measures your life only in terms of output, how much you produce, not in terms of the quality of your life experiences. We live in a materialistic culture that emphasizes being productive. We get messages that something is wrong with spending time attending to the soul. To be a soulful person means to go against all the pervasive, prove-yourself values of our culture, and instead treasure what is unique and internal and valuable in yourself and your own personal evolution. Sadly, some people wait until they have a heart attack or ulcers, or have a teenage child who gets into trouble, or until their spouse leaves them, or the like, to attend to their soul needs. The disastrous experience pushes them to it. But you don't have to wait for disaster. You can open yourself to the possibility of nourishing your soul, and you can make it a priority. Take careful stock of the ways you spend your life energies doing things that are not so nourishing. Often in the middle adult years especially, people find that they have been busy being productive in some task-oriented way, some way in which their souls were excluded. The responsibilities of everyday life, taking the kids to school, paying the bills, doing the grocery shopping, all the stuff that life requires of mature adults, expand to fill the entire life. When you're so consumed, you don't have very many moments in which to experience the soul. There is a little myth about how if you were on the road to Athens, you had to pass Procrustes and his bed. He would place you on his bed, and if you were too tall, he cut off your feet. If you were too short for the bed, he stretched you as if you were on a medieval rack until you filled it. The myth is a metaphor for how we are shaped to fit expectations of our cultures and families. The qualities that lead to success are stretched. We concentrate on developing them. To fit in, we cut ourselves off from what is unvalued by others and lose part of our souls in the process. What we reject of ourselves, we bury alive in the unconscious. Loss of soul creates a void, an emptiness that people fill with addictive activities, because it is the path of least resistance to sit in front of the television or work a couple of hours more or complete something from the to-do list. Yet it is very possible to make changes that will lead back to the lost parts of yourself, back to those lost parts of your soul. The decision to reconnect with your soul is similar to any choice to change things for the better, whether it's to stop smoking or to lose 20 pounds. Become aware of how deprived your life is of sources of joy, sources of beauty, and sources of creativity, which are all soul sources. Find the silent parts of yourself, the parts of you that have atrophied from disuse. Ask yourself, what gave me pleasure as a child? Maybe it was fishing or gardening or working with your hands or sculpting things or whittling or painting. Go down into your unconscious and reconnect with dismembered parts of yourself that were important. Remember and reconnect with what really gave you pleasure when you were younger and had more time, for going back to it may lead you to soul. When you recover or discover something that nourishes your soul and brings joy, care enough about yourself to make room for it in your life. A woman I know loved dancing, but hadn't danced for decades because she lacked a partner. She recently began ballroom dancing. All it took was the realization that she could take a class to bring dancing back into her life. The decision to do so followed, which reanimated a wonderfully soul-filled source of pleasure for her. When you attend to the needs of the soul, you experience a sense of freedom. In the midst of absorption in a soul-nourishing activity, we are liberated, creative, unaware of time, and in harmony with ourselves. When we attend only to work and neglect the soul, we may dream of being imprisoned, and we are often tense because we carry the weight of our joyless world on our shoulders. Soul-satisfying experiences open us to respond to the beauty around us, in others and in the world. As I experience it, appreciation of beauty is access to the soul. With beauty in our lives, we walk and carry ourselves more lightly and with a different look in our eyes. To look into the eyes of someone beholding beauty is to look through the windows of the soul. Anytime we catch a glimpse of soul, beauty is there. Anytime we catch our breath and feel, how beautiful, the soul is present.
A physician who has cared for and counseled patients with life-threatening illnesses, Bernie Siegel authored Love, Medicine, and Miracles, Peace, Love, and Healing, and How to Live Between Office Visits, A Guide to Life, Love, and Health.
Love, The Work of the Soul, by Bernie Siegel, M.D. In my work as a physician, I've observed that people who face life-threatening illness are often able to recover the ability that most of us have lost by the time we reach adulthood, the ability to connect with the soul. The child's sense of awe and wonder is too often replaced by a preoccupation with how we look and whether we're making enough money and what will the neighbors think and what do our parents think and what did our school teachers tell us and what does our religion say. In other words, our intellect controls us. But in many cases, people who have become aware of their mortality find that they've gained a freedom to live. They are seized with an appreciation for the present. Every day is my best day. This is my life. I'm not going to have this moment again. They spend more time with the things and people they love and less time on people and pastimes that don't offer love or joy. This seems like such a simple thought. Shouldn't we all spend our lives that way? But we tend not to make those kind of choices until somebody says, you have 12 months to live. I can walk into a room of strangers and tell who in the room has had a serious loss or a life-threatening illness by their answers to three questions. The first is, I'm taking you all to dinner. What do you want to eat? The second question is, I'd like you to hold up something that will enlighten everyone here as to what life is about. What would you hold up? Question number three is, how would you introduce yourself to God? If you haven't had a life-threatening illness, you'll spend a long time deciding how to answer question number one, because you're worried about my paying the check, and you'll want to be sure that you don't make an overly extravagant choice, and I also get what I want when we go out. So you sit there silently for 5 minutes thinking, and never tell me what you want to eat. But if you've had a serious illness, you'll shout lobster at me, or whatever other food you love. When I ask what you would hold up to enlighten people about life, and you say, a mirror, or myself, then I know you've been through enough to really understand your beauty and your value, and for people who face their mortality, the introduction to God is usually, God already knows me, I'm God's child, and I don't need an introduction. But if someone plans to introduce himself or herself by saying, God, I'm a lawyer, or a doctor, or a mother, I suspect that God's answer would be, come back when you know who you are. I believe that we're here to contribute love to the planet, each of us in our own way, Whether you're a waiter or a waitress or a manager or a barber or run a gas station, if you meet other people and are giving something to other people, then you're contributing. To nourish your soul, you've got to do what you do out of love. I'm not telling you to be selfish, but to be trapped in a job you hate or required to play a role that you don't want to play day after day can be deadly to the soul. Of course, people will argue that they can't possibly change jobs because of expenses or insurance or the state of the economy, and I have two responses. First is, find something in your life, whether it's volunteer work or painting a picture or writing a poem, about which you can say, "This is my joy." The other key is to recognize that if you don't like your life, and if you can't change your external circumstances at this point, you can change your attitude towards your life. You can say, "All right, I choose to be happy. I choose to view what I do every day as a way of contributing love." When you go about your life with this attitude, you'll find that your circumstances do begin to change. As one woman told me, "When I decided to come in to work happy, everybody around me became happy." This woman had decided to quit a job she hated, and on the last day of her 2 weeks' notice, she woke up happy. At the end of the day, she noticed that everyone around her was happy too, so she didn't quit after all. She decided to come to work happy instead. 2 years later, she's still on the job, radiating happiness and love. To paraphrase something the anthropologist Ashley Montague once said, "The way I change my life is to act as if I'm the person I want to be." This, to me, is the simplest, wisest advice you can give anyone. When you wake up and act like a loving person, you realize not only that you're altered, but that the people around you are also transformed, because everybody is changed by the reception of this love. I've learned from this principle to take responsibility for what bothers me. I don't blame my wife for not turning out the lights or not living up to my expectations in some other way. And if I do something to upset her, I say I'm sorry. I act more loving. And of course, I'm changed and she's changed and I'm happier and everybody around me is affected. Part of living with love is also learning how to say no. Now, this may sound selfish, but in fact, what it means is that we are choosing how we will love the world that day. If someone calls you up and asks you to change your plans and you don't want to, you don't need to be sick or have some other external excuse for turning the person down. You can simply say no. Saying yes out of love is fine. If someone calls you and asks, "Can you help me?" and as an expression of love for that person, you answer, "I'll drop everything right now," that's great. But to act out of need, guilt, or obligation rather than out of love, that's not soul work. If you need help, observe your pets. Animals know their nature and live it. Find your true path. It's so easy to become someone we don't want to be, even without realizing it's happening. We are created by the choices we make every day. And if we take action in order to please some authority figure, we suddenly wake up down the road and say, "This isn't me. I never wanted to be this person." I found that keeping a daily journal or writing a daily poem is a wonderful way to stay in touch with what's important and who I want to be. Journal and poem writing help me integrate what I'm experiencing, rather than shutting off the events of my life from my emotions. I used to be incredulous at how many gory and heartbreaking things I'd see in the hospital every day. I couldn't even remember what they were when I got home at night. Yet I knew they were in me because I knew how awful I was feeling. So I began to write about these things, making brief notes during the day if I needed to. Let's say I saw a terrible auto accident on the corner. I'd write "auto accident" on a piece of paper. And later, when I got home, I'd write a few paragraphs about what happened. Then I'd paint pictures for a couple of hours or write a poem about the experience, and I'd come out of that room feeling more at peace. I've begun writing a poem each morning, and the themes that come up tell me what's going on in my life at a deep level, what I need to work on. For instance, I wrote a poem recently about silence. It began, "Fax, phone, mail, life. Whose home is this? What do we all want?" I remember hearing nothing surrounded by sand dunes and nature, God, how beautiful and deafening is silence. I need to be silent inside until I can return to the silence outside. I don't consider myself a great poet, but these lines express my reaction to coming home from a restful vacation and finding that the messages and the machines and other pressures awaiting me make me feel as though I'm not in charge of my life. I've learned from this to turn my fax off when I go away. I don't want to come home to 10 feet of paper. And you know, the world doesn't end. But even when you can't turn off the phone or the fax, there are ways to bring quiet to your world every day. The phone can be a bell of mindfulness, reminding you to breathe peace when it rings. We need to be attentive to ways of building this kind of respite into our lives so that outside demands and expectations don't take control. For example, I like to go for a run every morning. I call this my talking to God time because I'm not in charge of my thoughts during that hour. The repetitive movement, for some people this might be riding a bike or walking, puts me in sort of a trance state. And then the lid is off, and all kinds of things surface. What's bothering me? What's making me happy? Whatever I need to deal with or talk about. I look around at the wonder of nature, and nature gives me lots of answers. If you watch how nature deals with adversity, continually renewing itself, you can't help but learn. When I jog, I love to run through cemeteries, and sometimes I stop to read the headstones. I saw one on Cape Cod recently, at the grave of a man who died at 28, so young. The message read, "His life taught us how to live, his death, how to die." That's what ought to be on every headstone. I'd say this boy accomplished whatever he needed to accomplish in 28 years. Now, other people had on their headstones that they went to Yale or Harvard, or that they were lawyers or manufacturers. But I don't think God cares where we are graduated or what we did for a living. God wants to know who we are. Discovering this is the work of the soul, and it's our true life's work. As a matter of fact, over God's desk are two plaques. One says, "God forgets everything you remember, and God remembers everything you forget." And the other says, "Don't feel totally, eternally, irrevocably responsible for everything. That's my job, God."
Thomas More is a psychotherapist, writer, and lecturer. He has written about Jungian psychology, mythology, imagination, and the arts in such books as Care of the Soul, Soulmates, and Meditations.
Embracing the Everyday by Thomas More, PhD. I've come to believe, through many years of reading and thinking about the issue, that the soul is really very broad, much broader than we tend to think. It encompasses not just the higher or transcendent level of consciousness, the realm that we traditionally call spirit, but also what we might refer to as the lower level of consciousness, the soul in ordinary experience, the soul in everyday life. The higher level has to do with developing an overview or philosophy of life, a sense of moral conviction, an idea of what the world is all about and our place in it. These concerns have long been highly valued and addressed through worship, prayer, and other traditional forms of spirituality. I've devoted most of my writing and teaching to emphasizing the lower part of the soul. Not because I believe the higher part is unimportant, it is indeed important, but because the lower aspect has been so neglected. What I mean by this lower level is the value of living one's day-to-day life with attention to essential everyday qualities, such as beauty, intimacy, community, imagination. I sometimes refer to a famous dream of Carl Jung's, in which he was going downstairs, descending from one level to the next. This dream was associated with a period of profound discovery. In our culture, however, we are so focused on success and progress that everyone talks about going up the ladder. No one talks about going down the ladder. We have lost the sense of how we might find religion and piety in the most ordinary experiences. Many theologies, including Christian, Jewish, Buddhist, and the ancient Greek religion, suggest that divinity exists deep within everyday experience. For example, Christian theologians have talked about the immanence of God, immanence meaning God residing within us. Part of the ancient Greek religion was a sense that the gods and goddesses inhabited not just heaven or the deep underworld, but nature itself. They were to be found right within ordinary life. We need to rediscover this awareness. To me, for example, a dwelling is truly a sacred space. I don't mean this romantically or fantastically, but I think there is a kind of spirit and inherent sacredness within a home, within a region, within trees, bodies of water, any particular place or terrain. We don't have to look up into the sky to some infinite emptiness in order to find the sacred. That search has its place. But a sense of the infinite is only part of a much fuller spirituality that can encompass ordinary experience as well. I think many of the troubles we run into are due to our own treating the sacred as something abstract. This attitude is part of what allows us to do great harm to nature and ourselves. If our religion is completely ethereal, we may become numb to the consequences of, for example, building a chemical plant that could be toxic to children in the community. Not only that, but restricting religion to a high-in-the-sky place tends to make people polemical about their own moral positions, to the degree that they can justify harming others who disagree with them. We've seen this phenomenon take place in country after country. I think we'd be able to live in this world more peaceably if our spirituality were to come from looking not just into infinity, but very closely at the world around us, and appreciating its depth and divinity. When we are so estranged from the everyday presence of the sacred, how can we rekindle a relationship with the soul? There are many ways, though they're not necessarily easy. A good beginning is to stop what we're doing every so often. Take time out from the crazy pace we're caught up in, and use that time to contemplate, whether through formal meditation or by talking to each other more deeply or simply by enjoying nature. Even a vacation can be a form of contemplation, if you do it in a way that's not hyperactive, though a lot of people find this difficult. A related idea is not to be too active or forceful about planning our lives. I don't mean we shouldn't think about the future at all, but it's so easy for our ambitions to get in the way of caring for the soul. What I've tried to do, rather than let my ambitions drive me, is to listen to what's going on around and within me as an indication of which direction I should go. What I find is that this process of listening and responding often leads me back in the direction of my family. People I deal with in the media are often surprised that I put family needs before some potentially grand media success. I could be away from home every day of the year if that kind of success and excitement were my first priority. But it's terribly important to me to protect those things that are most intimate. Ultimately, my family gives me more pleasure than whatever outside opportunity looks alluring at the moment. Our close relationship with others, family and friends, are possibly the most soulful aspects of our lives. These relationships do not always bring immediate gratification. In fact, they can be quite difficult, but they help ground us. We need people in our lives with whom we can be as open as possible. To have real conversations with people may seem like such a simple, obvious suggestion, but it involves courage and risk. I think it's a big mistake to think of the soul as strictly an internal experience. To be able to express our most intimate feelings and thoughts without fear of betrayal is one of the great quests of the life of the soul. And an important step in soul care is to give time and attention to those relationships that allow us to do this. When we express ourselves, I think it's valuable to use a language that's our own. These days, a lot of people talk to each other in the language they hear on television or in magazines and books, and we end up sounding like an armchair psychologist or an anthropologist or some other kind of expert. We need to work at speaking from the heart rather than from this mind that is so influenced by the culture at large. The discovery of our own language, our own way of thinking about and describing things, can help us be truly present, more fully open to others and receptive to experience. Another way to encourage the opening of the soul is to notice where we feel we are going wrong, where the symptoms are. We can look around and see where our relationships are failing, where our depressions or other emotional troubles seem to be focused, where our addictions lie. By looking carefully at what's wrong, we discover the exact areas that need attention. Take loneliness, for example. Loneliness is rarely a matter of not having enough people around. In fact, many folks say they're lonely even though their lives are filled with people. Our inclination is usually to treat loneliness in a narcissistic way, as a personal problem. Okay, come into therapy with me and we'll explore the roots of your loneliness and try to understand it so you won't have it anymore. But if we look carefully at what loneliness is telling us, we can see it as an invitation to respond to the world, to become more fully engaged with it and put ourselves out for it. There are so many ways in which we're needed, so many ways to become engaged, whether it's volunteering at a soup kitchen or offering a foster home to children who need one, or visiting someone in the hospital. I think we need to look for community, not just in this superficial sense of gathering in the same place to have fun, but also by feeling compassionately what others are going through and responding with our time and our hearts. Another aspect of loneliness has to do with an understanding of solitude. Loneliness is sometimes a sign that we need to learn what it takes for us to be constructively alone, grounded in our own natures, willing to take responsibility for making our own decisions and shaping our own lives. Dealing thoughtfully with both of these aspects of loneliness, connection and solitude, can be so much more nurturing than the search for a quick fix that's so common in our society. Another way to become more attuned to the divinity around us is by turning to the arts and the great religions for education and inspiration. For example, I spend a great deal of time reading ancient Greek tragedy and poetry because I think these expressions of belief and emotion have so much to say about the life of the soul. Or I'll read books or look at paintings from the Italian Renaissance, because I think that's a particularly soulful period in European history. I look at African art very closely, or listen to the music of India. Each person has his or her own way of knowing which forms of art offer greatest nourishment for that person's soul. There are so many rich sources of art and reflection all around us. You could spend several lifetimes feeding your soul just within the walls of a public library or museum. Unfortunately, our society has reduced the life of art to entertainment. We don't need to be entertained nearly as much as we need to give the soul the images it craves. Yet we allow Hollywood and the entertainment industry to distract us, to sell us superficial stories with exploitative characters and formulaic plots. I don't mean this in a snobbish way at all. Truly excellent popular songs can be nourishing, as can a film that stimulates reflection or stirs your heart. Even the occasional television sitcom penetrates below the surface and touches something deeper. But I do think we should only demand the best and be willing to shut the television off, to go to the movies we believe will be worthwhile and walk out if they're not, to read books that offer depth. In making these various suggestions, I don't want to imply that I view caring for the soul as making a project out of your life. There's already much judgment against oneself, either implied or explicit, in magazines, newspapers, and television these days. Popular psychology has put a terrible weight on people with this kind of moralism that says we should continually be improving ourselves, becoming something other than we are. If people are having trouble finding ways to care for the soul, it may be that they imagine the task is too big a project. It really isn't. All you need to do is look right at this moment and ask yourself, what around you is requesting your attention? Is it that you would like to take a bath? Is it that your neighbor across the street is having some trouble and needs your time for a while? Is it that your house needs a little bit of paint on the side wall? Is it that your city council needs someone to speak up about what's going on in your community? The key is to give up the project of making yourself something shiny and big and to recognize that we are very ordinary people. By learning to discover and value our ordinariness, we nurture a friendliness towards ourselves and the world that is the essence of a healthy soul.
Joan Borisenko is a medical scientist, psychologist, and author of many books, including Minding the Body, Mending the Mind, The Power of the Mind to Heal, and A Pocketful of Miracles.
Ensouling Ourselves by Joan Borisenko, PhD. To nourish the soul means to become kinder, more compassionate, wiser, and more loving, often through the making of difficult choices that foster growth rather than safety. The nourishment and growth of the soul is the very reason for human life. When we nourish the soul, we nourish God, increasing the abundance of the life that we can see, our children, our society, and the levels of the life that we don't see at all. In a larger sense, soul is the substance of the universe, knowing itself and growing itself. Growth of the soul is our goal, and there are many ways to encourage that growth, such as through love, nature, healing our wounds, forgiveness, and service. The soul grows well when giving and receiving love. I nourish my soul daily by loving others and being vulnerable to their love. Love is, after all, a verb, an action word, not a noun. You can only experience it by receiving it or giving it away. Animals are great lovers and have always been an important part of our family life. Nature is another important aspect of nourishing the soul. After a hike in the mountains where we live, for instance, I feel a remarkable sense of gratitude and awe. My mind quiets down and allows me to see more clearly the beauty of creation. And through that gratitude, the beauty of the universe is reflected back to the Creator. Unfortunately, not all is beauty and peace. I don't believe I've ever met a person who hasn't been challenged or wounded by something. Difficulties present choices we can either waste away from our wounds or use them to grow our souls. My husband, for example, is a survivor of the Second World War. As a child, he suffered through 6 years of bombings, near escapes, and concentration camps. Part of his soul work has been the gradual transformation of this deep well of grief and pain. As he heals himself, he also participates in healing that terrible idea of war in others. I have always said that no one heals alone. We heal through and for one another. In Judaism, this is referred to as Tikkun Olam, the healing or restoration of the world, a kind of collective soul work. The process of making sense of our wounds is a very personal one, but a common theme in wound healing is the universal need to forgive. If we don't forgive ourselves for our mistakes and others for the wounds they have inflicted upon us, we end up crippled with guilt. And the soul cannot grow under a blanket of guilt because guilt is isolating, while growth is a gradual process of reconnection to ourselves, to other people, and to a larger whole. Soul, the basic substance of the universe, yearns for connection. The interconnectedness of our souls makes service for others a natural joy. Studies have shown that people who volunteer and serve others are healthier and happier. Some of the most peaceful and soulful people I've ever met are those in 12-step programs who are working on the 12th step, which is to help other people in their recoveries. Because of the interconnectedness of soul, when we help others, we are, in a sense, helping ourselves. Years ago, an interesting study was conducted at a children's summer camp where two opposing teams were locked in a violent conflict. The need to cope with a common threat was used to resolve the hostility. A truck bringing water for the camp was purposely knocked onto its side. The kids, not realizing this was staged, all worked together to solve the water crisis. Pulling together creates tremendous bonds between people. It nourishes our collective souls. Today, the importance of community and service to others is echoed from every corner. Robert Keck, in his book Sacred Eyes, explains this by noting that in terms of the timeline of creation, human beings are now just coming out of adolescence. And it is natural to separate ourselves from others and from God during this adolescence. As we look back at the way people acted in the 1980s, we can see that there was a national topping out of greed and isolation. Now we see an end to the idea that a successful life consists of putting oneself first. However, I don't see us coming out of our collective adolescence into 1,000 years of peace. As long as we inhabit human bodies, strife and turmoil will exist, for we live on a planet made up of opposites. We have day and night, sickness and health, good and evil, male and female, up and down. Tension is unavoidable. But some tension is necessary for the soul to grow, and we can put that tension to good use. We can look for every opportunity to give and receive love, to appreciate nature, to heal our wounds and the wounds of others, to forgive and to serve. Besides doing things with and for other people, we all need to take time for ourselves. Part of taking time for ourselves includes a daily spiritual routine. My routine is morning and evening prayers and meditation, sometimes for an hour and other times for just a few minutes. Tuning in to the Spirit helps me live on purpose and bring forth my gifts, whether writing a poem, cooking a meal, planting flowers, giving a workshop, or writing a book. In taking time to open ourselves to our souls, we become better givers to others and are better able to see the love that is the universe. Albert Einstein once said that the most important question a human being could answer is the universe a friendly place? A spiritually optimistic point of view holds that the universe is woven out of a fabric of love. Everything that is happening is ultimately for the good if we are willing to face it head on and use our adversities for soul growth. The opposite of spiritual optimism is religious pessimism. This view sees God as judgmental, punitive, and ready to send us to eternal damnation if we make a mistake. This kind of belief in an unfriendly universe is toxic to the soul rather than soul nourishing. As soon as we begin to question toxic beliefs and open up to faith in a friendly universe, the proverbial path opens before us. The people, events, and teachings we need are supplied. This is the action of grace. When we are open to grace, we find that people appear in our lives who encourage the growth of souls.
This book is continued on the next cassette.